everybody, welcome to the ANN After Show. It's me and James today talking about Maiden Abyss and also talking about all the new shows that have dropped in the last week. There will be more. We'll maybe talk about those next week. Unfortunately, Jackie can't be with us this time. I know she's here in spirit and she'll probably watch this whole thing later, but you're just going to have to make do with me and James talking about Foppa's butthole. And
I know Jackie's going to be so sad that she missed out on
so
all the
disappointed
butthole conversations.
That she's
That's
not going to
get her favorite part of the show. And the vor.
And the cannibalism.
Yeah.
And, you know, just all the great stuff we've come to expect from Maiden Abyss, Season 2, Scorching Sun, Golden City. God.
I mean, to be clear, I thought this episode was incredible and wonderful, but also, you know, got a bunch of weird shit in it. So.
Yeah, somebody's eyeballs falling out for pretty much the entire runtime. No one makes note of it. They just talk to them, like, you know, it happens.
Give her a courtesy, like push
like
in.
Little plop it back in there a little bit, please. Come on, guys. Like, all right. But before we get into all the ridiculous, gruesome, depressing, sad stuff that happened in the finale of Maiden Abyss, we're going to talk about a bunch of new shows that just came out that we're excited about, or mostly excited about, or were just interesting and hard to pin down. Looking at you, Pop Team Epic.
So before
we get started,
no
started
trash
that,
fires yet. So that's
no trash. That's true. I think one show got like a 1.5 from one reviewer. I don't even remember which one it was, but there has not been.
I think it was the isekai one or the.
Have we even had an isekai?
No,
yet?
Wait. It was the I want to say it is the is it Beast Tamer?
Oh, Beast Tamer is the only one that kind of got the thumbs down from one of our reviewers. But most of the stuff so far has been middling to awesome. Mm-hmm. So before we get to that, I just want to remind everyone to please subscribe to this channel. The ANN After Show is live on Mondays, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. You're going to want to be here for this season because everything is so good. I can't entirely decide if we're going to commit full. Well, okay, we're going to commit to Chainsaw Man, but also lots of other shows. I think regularly be checking in on those because it we can't.
This
ignore
is too
them.
Much. This
There's
is
too much. Much. Too much good stuff. Too much good stuff. So, you're going to want to be here for that. So make sure to give us a like, subscribe, share. We're also on Twitter Spaces and on Facebook if you still use that. Or you can listen to the audio version that goes up on Tuesdays.
I'm sure we have plenty of fans that are like in their late 40s to early 50s that are wanting to catch up with their anime news while also checking in on like how their nieces and nephews are doing with their soccer games. And
I'm gonna put your email in the comments so that they can flame you specifically.
I only say that because there is an entire like generation of my family mm-hmm. with whom I can only contact via Facebook anymore.
Yes, yeah.
So I'm speaking from lived experience here.
Do they also watch live stream videos about anime, James?
I mean, they should, you know. I'm sure they really want
to support you. Yeah. They should. If they were, good aunts and uncles, they'd be here every week just being like, good job, James. Proud of you.
I'm going to be at the next family reunion, and my auntie's going to be like, so when you talked for 10 minutes about the little kitty girl's butthole, what was that a metaphor? Or no, auntie. No, it is very literal.
It's real. Right. So there's also an audio version of this. It goes up on Spotify, Apple Music, Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcast. You can catch us there each week as well, but you're missing out on our beautiful faces if you do that. So, yeah. But on the other hand, you can't really watch YouTube videos in your car, or you shouldn't. So.
Oh, and a lot of people are like me and have begrudgingly subscribed to YouTube Premium simply to say, so they can treat the service as a podcast app.
So funny you mentioned that. I signed up for YouTube Premium for like a hot 10 minutes because it said you'd be able to download video using it. And I needed like one video for something work related. And I wanted to download it without trying to figure out, a reliable browser plugin that wasn't going to give me problems. Oh, yeah. And then they're like, no, we just saved this on like you're in a locked away area profile. Like, it's like, this is garbage.
Or Funimation, or it's downloaded so that you can like watch it on an airplane, but you can't do anything with it.
Yeah. So I immediately unsubscribed, and now I get messages all the time. They're like, hey, come back. It's like, no.
No. Hey, and according to Russell Martins, we have a household that includes a pair of late 40s Facebook users and massive anime fans.
Hey,
and
Russell.
Answer your question from earlier. Hell yeah.
All right. We appreciate you, Russell, and your entire household. You do you, buddy. We're glad you're here. All right, let's get cracking on this new season. Like we said, I'm sure everyone is waiting for Chainsaw Man to drop here pretty soon, unless you're going to New York Comic Con this weekend. You'll get to watch it early, or, you know, if you got a screener. But if you didn't get a screener, that's the earliest you can watch it. Otherwise, you got to wait for it to be streaming on Crunchyroll. Mob Psycho is also dropping this week on Wednesday. So we're not talking about those yet because they're not out yet. But Saturday, October 1st was really busy for us. There, we launched with four shows to start with because we included the second half of Bastard, and Master with No Tail premiered on the 30th. Villainess aired early, so we had the first episode of that, and then the new Legend of Galactic Heroes also aired before October 1st. So we launched with all of those, and then that same day we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 shows. Yeah.
I had to take my car to the shop, and I straight up was just watching Pop Team Epic in the lobby because I had to stay caught up with everything.
I was really impressed because you sent an email and you're like about how you were going to send in your reviews from your phone. How do you guys write reviews on your mobile devices?
We're just broken. We're broken by technology and broken by society. So honestly, I write with for Preview Guide because there's so many to write, and I don't want to like have to keep, because I can only really take screenshots of certain shows either on my phone. Some of them I have to watch it on my computer, but I don't like, for some reason, I've never liked just sitting down and watching like TV on my computer.
I don't like it either.
I'll write a lot of my previews just in bed on my phone. Uh-huh. And then I get my screenshots when I hop on the computer. So yeah, I do a lot of writing on my phone, actually.
Oh, that's okay. The anime show says voice to text. Do you use that, or are you actually like swiping? You're swiping the whole thing?
Yeah. I'm not even swiping. I'm just two-thumbing it.
You still have a phone that has one of those pull-out keyboards, or
No. I got a touch keyboard, but it's
Okay.
So I have a very big screen, so I can.
Right. Okay. So there are like added things coming into this so that you can do it. I was imagining you swiping your entire reviews. No, like, how are these not loaded with misspellings when you send them into me?
No.
So okay.
Plus, right. I use my phone version of Microsoft Word, so it has spell check and everything.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Which doesn't really help with all the Japanese names, but
yeah. Yeah. Then you have to tell it like, no, I really did mean that. And this one too.
Unless I didn't, because sometimes I swap an O and a U, and then it doesn't. I'm just like, no, that's right, Microsoft. And then the perils of writing about media that's in another language.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. So I think the first one to start with, let's get straight to the good stuff and talk about the premiere for the second half of Spy Family. Borf is the key word there. We got hints at the end of the last season that we'd be meeting Bond. I guess he's still not named. Sorry, spoilers. The dog's name's Bond.
Her favorite thing is Bond, man. That's not, I don't think.
Yeah. So we had gotten some hints, not from the actually final episode. It was the episode before they hinted about the dog. And then we had the actual finale and the dog wasn't talked about at all. And then in this episode, we finally meet the giant Borf dog who can see the future. And Anya can read his mind. So through that convoluted relationship, Anya can kind of get hints about the future, at least from the dog's perspective. But
it's honestly a perfect, of course, the family pet is also going to have a secret superpower and a presumably convoluted backstory.
Yes.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Because he's all part of this secret society, not secret society, secret government project called Project Apple, which was done through, I think, genetic splicing to try and like get, you know, better results. And it was shut down. And so he and a bunch of other dogs are presumably the last remainder of that project.
Not those buff dogs though, right? Buff dogs are just
there are buff dogs. Oh my gosh.
I was dying when they were just flexing in the window trying to...
I have a picture of the buff dogs. It was sent in and then not used. Not used in the preview guide. So I'll just share it real quick so you guys can appreciate this really this Doberman and this six pack. He kind of looks like an English bulldog, but he's too big. And this looks like a bloodhound, I think, over here, kind of. That dog used to show up in like Aristocats and all these other Disney movies a lot. But these dogs aren't genetically modified as far as we know. They are, because the first place Lloyd takes Anya to get her dog, which is a reward for getting her first star, is to a pet shop that specifically has dogs trained by like the spy organization that Lloyd works for. And so Anya, I wish I had the reaction shot, because she looks at these dogs and she's like, they're like, not,
oh, man.
Oh no, I'm not doing that.
These are not kawaii.
No, Dad, I don't like these dogs. So then they end up going to her and Yor go to an adoption event. There's all these cute dogs, but she accidentally, I think, reads the mind of Bond and kind of thinks there's something going on. So she sneaks out, even though she's not supposed to, follows him up there and, you know, finds the terrorist organization, and her and Bond have to figure a way out. 10-10, especially because the opening is fantastic.
Yeah, it is.
The ending is too. It's got a great opening and ending sequence this time. The opening doesn't have the same stylistic choice as the first season, where it was sort of like, it reminded me a little bit of Madeline, the French cartoon.
Yeah, and it like was sort of from Anya's like sort of perspective, like her artistic interpretation. I missed that a bit, but there's also just Yor being the ultimate queen.
Yeah.
Death and murder for like 5 seconds, and I was like, okay.
Yeah, there's a bunch of just really cool stuff going on in the opening sequence. And the ending sequence all takes place in the apartment. It keeps doing these really cool camera shifts that give you a sensation that it's like in a 3D environment. And we see them like try to, like Anya tries to make breakfast and completely ruins it. And then they all make breakfast together. I think you get a shot of Yor's burnt omelet because she can't cook. Like nothing draws attention to it. But if you look at it while she's holding it, there's like black spots all over it. One of my favorite parts from the ending is when we see Anya and Frankie together, and Frankie just seems like an uncle this great uncle character is making her laugh. So just more wholesome goodness. They're definitely going to get that dog. And but their apartments start to seem a little small to me for like,
I know they're European, they're tiny, like French Italian flat, you know.
Yeah,
it's like a Pyrenees. That dog is huge.
Yes, yeah, he is. Nikki, who's she's one of our contributors for this week in anime, she said some Korean fans point out that Twilight and Lloyd isn't shown in most of the OP shots because they're from his own perspective.
Oh, okay.
Now I'm gonna have to go rewatch it with that in mind, because I wasn't thinking about that at the time.
I like the time lapse that they use in the ending, just because I think when time lapse is used in like really good animation, there's just something about it that I find really visually like exciting, just because it's so hard to do.
And Griffaust mentions that there's a mystery woman in the ending sequence. There is a character we haven't met yet that's being shown briefly. She's in a shot in the opening sequence as well. She's got kind of like a silver bob. And you get a better look at her in the ending sequence based on the context in the opening. I think she works with Lloyd, but not necessarily for the spy organization, because it shows him in what looks like a hospital, and his like cover story is that he's a psychologist or a psychiatrist, right? I don't know if he actually like goes to a practice at any point, but he sees her or seems to interact with her in some kind of work environment. So hopefully we find out more about her later. Noel Gator also pointed out that the ending is by the director of Pompo the Cinephile. That's true. I saw that on Twitter earlier this week. And for those who don't know, Pompo the Cinephile wasn't animated by Wit or Cloverworks. It was actually animated by a studio. It's fairly new, called Clap, with two P's, if I remember right. So that was, Pompo the Cinephile, I have not seen, but heard really, really good things about as far as the animation and whatnot. So it's nice to see them like getting to work on such a well-known and well-liked property, because that ending sequence is really great. Yeah. Nikki says Lloyd does work at a hospital. Okay, so he does have a hospital cover story. So I would assume then that this mystery woman also works at that hospital.
But can I just say, as a final word on the Spy Family, that I love that Lloyd is out of commission for the whole episode because he's taking the world's longest dump. And Yori's just like, I hope he gets out of the bathroom soon. And it's been like, presumably like an hour. Like, it's been a while.
Yeah. 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 The dump is also a cover story. Like, he's trying to deal with the assassination attempt that's going to use these dogs. They're going to be bomb dogs to take out. Is it the prime minister of
the foreign minister?
A political figure from the other country that Lloyd's a spy for. So he's caught up in work, and Anya covers for him by telling Yor that he takes a really long time on the shitter. And that's the word they use. I'm not like just cursing for the hell of it. Like, Anya says the shitter in it. So no, I have only read the first three chapters or so of the manga. So I do not know the upcoming spoilers. Please don't share any spoilers in here if you have read the manga for the shows that we're about to talk about, because a lot of people are going to maybe listen or watch this and they have not necessarily read the source material. So we want everyone to have the best opportunity to enjoy the show. All right. So that was Spy Family. Let's try to make sense of Pop Team Epic, James.
You mean Endless Love, the greatest tokusatsu of our time?
That was a great review, by the way. So if you guys haven't had to preview guide, you can read both Nick and James's reviews. I tell the reviewers, specifically when it comes to Pop Team Epic, that you don't have to approach it like a normal show, because it doesn't approach itself like a normal show. So if you go read James's review, he took a unique angle to it. Nick went in a weird direction with his as well.
What
are you gonna do?
The show is aggressively terrible on purpose. Like, it is actively without any reason or point. Even when it isn't funny, there's no way to argue that that wasn't on purpose. So yeah. It's like, what do you even do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. In the in its return after several years, I really enjoyed the first season a lot. It's irreverent. It doesn't make any sense half the time, or it's referencing really obscure things. I mean, if you go watch the first season, there's like an extended stop motion sequence set to an Earth, Wind, and Fire song from the 70s.
The best bit,
like,
of the whole season, I think. I love that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this season opens with the return of Aoi Shota. Aoi Shota is a voice actor. He's been in a lot of music-based properties because he's a great singer. He's got, you know, some idol aspects to him, and they've had him show up as this time-traveling person, but now he encounters, like, dark Shota Aoi, and then it turns into a whole tokusatsu sequence.
And he's also like a Kamen Rider. So
Yeah. Like, now he's also a Kamen Rider, and he has to, you know, save Popoko and Pipimi from, or not destroy the timeline. Like, he's messing with timelines or something. And none of it matters, but it's really funny. and then it, you know, goes back into its little sequential nature. James, do you have, like, what do you think of the Bob Team Epic sequences?
So I am a native of, like, the kind of prime Adult Swim era. I grew up on Aqua Teen Hunger Force and all that stuff.
Home movies.
Yes. And so I have a soft spot for anything that is just deliberately ugly and stupid. So, and I was honestly really impressed with the ways in which Bob Team Epic was able to be somehow even uglier with the CG animation, where like the ridiculous, like multi-layered 2D models that they strip, like it's, I don't even know how to describe it. It's they
kind of Paper Mario sort of thing where it's like 3D, two dimensional. And it's like, so there's PPMe, and she's claiming to be like a fortune teller and that she can tell your fortune involving the stained glass window, which is like this awful picture of Popuko riding a horse. And then everything just gets really weird. And then I don't even remember what the fortune was. It doesn't really matter. It's just like, it's just that I hope we also see the return of the, like the French animator that they trolled all last season.
Yes.
In the first season, they would bring on, they do these segments where they would have a French animator who worked. I don't remember with which animation studio that did, because the segments are all usually kind of broken up between different studios. And so they would just record him talking. And then the other gimmick about Pop Team Epic is that the first half is dubbed with two female voice actors. And then the second half is two male voice actors. Often the voice actors also have a pre-existing camaraderie, like they've appeared together in other, or well known for appearing together in other things. And
They got like Goku and Vegeta, or like
They had Nana Mizuki, I think, and I forget who else in this one. But anyway, in the previous season, the first half, there wouldn't be any subtitles for what the French guy was saying, like at all, and you'd have to watch the second half if you wanted to have any idea what he was talking about. And I don't remember it being particularly super insightful or whatever. They were just, this poor guy, I think he probably just was working on this and they're like, wouldn't it be funny if we got the one foreign guy in the Japanese studio and made him say stuff and the Japanese audience would have no idea what he's saying because he speaks French. And then
there was also the segments that were legitimately, there wasn't any joke, like they were completely, am I remembering that wrong? Like
probably
they're just little slice of life bits in French or something. And
right. Yes. Yeah.
And there was no joke. Like they weren't even for comedy. They were just like little vignettes.
Because they would have like, Popuko and PPMe like talk about a baguette or something like that. Yeah. It was more, and that in turn, I also thought might have been them trolling the French guy.
Hilarious.
We're just going to have them do something stereotypically French. Ha ha ha. Or something like that.
I want them to get like Nathan Fielder from Nathan For You to like try to market the show to like to HBO or something. Like,
that would be funny. That would be really funny because one of their promo videos, and we showed it during the trailer watch party, was they had obviously just taken people who weren't Japanese off the street in probably at a tourist area in Tokyo or something and told them like react to Pop Team Epic is coming back. Under the assumption that, you know, they probably had no idea. So they just have a video of a bunch of people going like, oh my God, I can't believe it. Like in English and stuff. Like, and they're just trolling foreigners. Yes. Perfect. Yeah. Nikki says those segments were done by a French animator and that was the, and they didn't tell him that they were going to do it. So they would just interview him and he didn't know that they were going to splice it in there. That's almost mean. Like it feels vaguely like hazing. I don't know. but this episode, there's also like an extended Final Fantasy joke where Nikki explained it a bit to me. Like it's like they're looking for a chocobo. So first there's a big Blair Witch reference where it's like found footage them in the spooky forest, and then they come out and there's a chocobo and Popuko and PPMe, and they're just like they play a medley version. I'm sure they did the medley well enough that they couldn't get sued for it, but it's still very obviously like the Chocobo song from Final Fantasy.
It sounded almost identical to me. Like it was the Chocobo theme with the...
Yeah. And then they're just going like... They're just doing this joke. So yeah, watch it. Just don't expect to understand anything that's going on.
Nope.
That's the point. They make a couple jokes about themselves too. Like they have like a fake press conference announcing the second season. And there's a character that makes a joke about how, like, if it wasn't funny or if it was funny, it wouldn't be Pop Team Epic. Like just like kind of mocking the fact that like the jokes don't make any sense. So yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that was Pop Team Epic. Happy to have it back. Intend to be even more confused than ever before. The next one I was hoping we could talk about was, why don't you talk about Raven of the Inner Palace? Because I really want to watch that. That was one of the ones I didn't get to yet.
So. Oh yeah. I mean, it's very cool. So the whole premise, and I was kind of trying to look it up because I'm honestly not super familiar with like Chinese history at all.
Yeah.
And I saw some mixed reports on whether it was just supposed to be a slightly fictionalized historical China, or if it's supposed to be more of like a vague Chinese-esque sort of society, but not necessarily contingent on any specific time period or figures. But the whole conceit is that there's a consort that lives kind of within the imperial coterie or whatever you want to call it, who is the Raven consort. And instead of acting as a lover to whoever the current emperor is, her job is to provide other services, like she's to solve problems. And in this case, like mysteries, because she has, and the first episode didn't really explain everything, but she has some sort of supernatural origin that gives her the ability to like interact with ghosts and to detect, like the first episode's about like a haunted jade earring. And so she can like detect that there's a spirit that is possessing this earring that died like a violent death. And so then she goes around and talking to the other mistresses and trying to figure out who this woman was and, you know, how she might have died and what it maybe has to do with like all these other conspiracies. And so there's this really cool mix of, if you're into like the court politics of kind of ancient China, imperial China, but there's also like an episodic kind of like mystery procedural format. And
yeah, this sounds like my bag completely.
Yeah. And the main character is like a cool goth chick that's also like an adorable little dork, which is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was cool. I dug it. I had a hard time. It's one of those things where, unfortunately, I tend to struggle, even with anime, I struggle with names a lot.
Yeah.
Like, I mix names up all the time. I have to keep notes. Mm-hmm. And with Chinese names, they have the same trouble. And so I had a hard time kind of following sometimes who was talking to who about whom. But obviously, I think that would just, you know, that would get easier.
As you start hearing like the same ones over and over again, it'll definitely get easier. Yeah. I only watched like the opening sequence and thought it was really strange because they show this weird bird monster sort of being in the, did they play the opening for the first episode?
I don't think so, no.
Okay, well, it is online. Like, they did officially publish it. So, yeah, once you see it, it seems like part of her supernatural connection might be this weird, like, bird woman creature. I'm not going to, not like a harpy necessarily.
Sure, but
some kind of mythological looking.
Like a Tengu?
Yeah, but Chinese. Not. But yeah. So I'll be interested to see, like, maybe they'll explain that a little more. But that was, I thought the opening was kind of ethereal but weird, so I'll have to get to that one before the second episode comes out for sure. On my side of things, I watched the newest episode of My Hero Academia season 6. I can't believe we're on season 6, episode 114. I haven't watched an anime that had this many episodes since Sailor Moon had 200 episodes. I don't think I've watched every episode of a show with that many since then.
The last time I saw anything that lengthy was probably Dragon Ball / Z when I was
yeah for sure. So I was just, it hasn't felt like it's been 114 episodes, but you know, I guess it's been airing for a while. For those who, you know, aren't caught up, I mean, I guess this is slight spoilers, so just like, I don't know, leave the room for a little while and come back. But it opens right up, and I have read, I think, all of this entire arc in the manga, pretty close to how the manga goes, with them basically preparing for war against the Paranormal Liberation Front, which is now the combining of the League of Villains and the Meta Liberation Front, I think is what they were called. And now they've combined together to become the Paranormal Liberation Front with Shigaraki at the helm of it. Redestro has kind of taken a back seat, and now they're kind of dealing with some merger issues and about like who is in charge and, you know, how to everyone to get along. If they originally came from the Meta Liberation Front, then, you know, their allegiances are more to Redestro, and they might not like, you know, these, because most of the League of Villains are on the maybe younger end of things, and they can be a little more impulsive. And then Hawks is still in the mix. They're trying to kind of play things up as a double agent for the heroes. So he's interacting with Twice a lot, which trying to give Twice advice about how to work both angles. But on the other end, Endeavor's leading this huge, with Mirko, is leading a siege on the hospital where the doctor has been making the Nomu experiments at. And so that's kind of where things come to a head. And they realize that, you know, the doctor's not really there because he's got Shigaraki in a vat and he's filling him full of quirks or whatever. So yeah, it was pretty intense from the get-go. And if it follows the manga closely, there won't be like any downtime as far as I can recall.
So it sounds like this isn't like a good jumping on point for newcomers. Like,
no. Yeah. No. If you were going to jump on for newcomers, I'm trying to think, like, you would at least want to watch the second half of last season to be able to follow the events in this season. But you're also going to want to have read up on like what happened to All Might and what happened to All For One and what's going on with Deku's powers and things like that to kind of be up to speed.
Yeah.
But I think if I remember the news correctly, this season's also supposed to run for a full half year with no breaks. Oh, man. Yeah. So it's just going to be.
Isn't Jujutsu Kaisen also going to run for like 6 months straight? Is that what I saw?
When that premieres, yes. I'm double checking if there's no breaks. I know that it is supposed to run for it. That season probably will premiere. It's going to premiere next year. And yeah, half a year without breaks as well. We don't know the month yet. It would be so cool if it was January, but it's probably not.
Godspeed, Mappa.
Yeah, Godspeed.
Because that's also when Attack on Titan's supposed to come out, right?
Yes. I keep forgetting. Yes, Attack on Titan, the final season, part 3, is supposed to come out next year as well. Let me double check if it's early next year or not. Bum, 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 bum. Final season part 3 just cracks me up. We do not have a confirmed month, I think.
Yeah, I think we've been guessing like late.
Because all the other ones have been December or
January.
Yeah. So yeah, not sure about that. But yeah, then Jujutsu Kaisen. Also, I think Chainsaw Man, people are saying it's only gonna run for 12 episodes.
I think I've seen similar rumblings. I don't know if we have a confirmation, but
we know that that's supposed to be how many ending themes there are, because it's going to have a bunch of unique ending themes. If they don't reuse any of the ending themes at any point, I think that's why people are coming to that. You can't fit the first part of Chainsaw Man in 12 episodes, though. And they intend to cover the whole thing. That's what the MAPPA CEO said. So if it's only 12 episodes and they take a break, MAPPA will be coming back to it. I don't know how they're doing any of this.
I was gonna say 24 I could definitely see part 1, but 12, yeah. I don't know how you
would have to cut a bunch of content, and they've been really emphasizing how they want to like get all of it in there. So I don't think they'll make a bunch of cuts just to wrap it up. So
I feel like they're going to get to maybe the end of, what's it, the bomb arc?
Oh, yeah, that would make, yeah, that would probably
like make a good stopping point. And
which means the things I'm really looking forward to seeing won't be in this season, right?
Halloween! Yeah.
Halloween! I know. Man. So, yeah, My Hero Academia Season 6, I think it's going to be a really fun ride. The opening sequence is really cool. Takes a lot of notes from American comics in there. And I can't recall if they showed, they probably showed an ending theme as well, but it was the opening that really stuck with me. And Mirko just kicks so much ass. And she already does in the first episode. And the next episode is named after her. So just expect like Mirko just.
Is this season that had the Man with a Mission did the theme, or is that last season?
This season is not Man with a Mission. There was a previous season with Man with a Mission, a Super Beaver, which is a band that will never not be funny to me. Does the opening?
Wait, that's the band name? Oh my god!
For this season, Super Beaver. They've done other themes. They've been around for a while. Man with a Mission did the second opening theme for last season.
Okay.
So yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, me too. And their wolf masks, very cool. Let's see. Okay, we have to talk about Mobile Suit Gundam: The Witch from Mercury. Everyone is talking about that show. Yes. That's why I kind of saved it here a little bit, because it's just like amazing.
Yeah.
The best.
I mean, when you combine the prologue with that first episode, it's like everything you could want in a Gundam show.
Yes.
Plus Utena.
Yes. Okay. So if you guys have been on the internet, you've probably seen people calling this, you know, like, oh, it's Utena in space, or Utena vibes, because there's a duel and, you know, there's a character who's like the fiance, and if you win the duel, you can claim her, which is, you know, basically the very bare bones premise of Utena. That's not the only reason why this is Utena, though. Like, it's not just that. Like,
no, they've also got shots from Utena. They've got
shot. The bride girl has a greenhouse, just like Anthony had a greenhouse. You know, she's growing vegetables and other things in it. Like, it doesn't physically look the same, but it's this, conceptually there's a lot of similarities.
Homie basically pulled an E.L. James and took his Utena like mecha fanfic and then brought it to Sunrise and was like, hey, can we just make this an official Gundam license thing, and changed some names around. And
I heard you were thinking about having like more girls in your Gundams. What if we also made those girls go out?
Yeah,
just and throwing it out there.
It's not subtext. Gay?
Nope.
It's not. It is. I mean, my favorite part of the whole episode, other than the ridiculously sick Gundam Ariel, which is one of my favorite designs.
So ever. Cool. It has
so good. Okay.
Well, I'll let you finish, and then I'll talk about why.
It has shoujo eyes, which is a great development for Gundam. Just like a great way to differentiate.
Yeah.
But I was laughing so hard when Mirin, the princess, she turns to the camera.
Yeah.
When Sileta's like, wait a minute, like, we can't, like, what do you mean get married? I'm a girl. And she like turns to the camera and is like, the stakes of this plot line are that you and I will get legally gay married. Don't be weird about it, because this is a story about us being married. Like, just staring right into the camera.
What she says is like, oh, Mercury must be pretty conservative. Like, this is totally normal here.
Yeah.
Gay marriage is just like, what's up with your weird backwater planet? Gay marriage, who cares? Is basically anyway, what it is.
Now. We're engaged. We're going to get married now.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just proposed to me with your sword.
Yeah. So one of the reasons the Gundam Ariel, and Ariel not like the mermaid, but Ariel like flying Ariel, is so cool is it has like this like nano machine style weapon that like can burst apart and like shoot a bunch of lasers and then come together and become a giant tower shield, not unlike the original like RX Gundam, but like it was just, I thought that was really cool. The way it's animated like is really intense. You're like, oh yeah, lasers, and
and also
that made sense.
Sileta is a precious, I think. And I say this with affection, because as a teacher, I have encountered many of these students.
Yeah.
But I think someone referred to her as the most homeschooled-ass Gundam protagonist. And I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
That is absolutely.
Yeah.
Every time I've had like a ninth or a 10th grader come in after like years of homeschooling, it's 100%. They're very earnest.
Yeah.
But kind of socially awkward vibe.
You're like, oh, your parents didn't socialize you with the other children, did they? They didn't sign you up for any. I was just having a conversation about this with someone earlier today. I was like, homeschooling's great, but you have to socialize your children. You have to take them out to be around other children to do things, or it'll be hard for them. Yeah, it's really good. I like that even though she's awkward like that, she's obviously very, very competent in her mobile suit. Totally kicks Seonji's butt. Right away.
Smacks it too.
So. Yeah, she does. Yeah. She challenges him to a duel by smacking his ass. I don't know where that came from, but like, or why. Like, that also could kind of be a play on Utena, because I think Seonji does get like bitch slapped at least once in that show across the face. And they're like, so you hear the smack sound, you don't actually see her do it. And then it becomes obvious that she like went up behind him and just like swatted his butt. Like she spanked him.
I'm watching Zeta Gundam right now.
Yeah.
And the main character, Camille, of that, there was a stretch of episodes in like the early run where he was straight up getting just backhanded across the face by every character, like every episode, to the point where I was almost thinking, like, is this a bit? Like, there's one episode where he gets smacked by like three different people, and it's like
in a single episode.
Stop abusing this boy! Like,
stop him, please. Please stop abusing this boy. Yeah. If you've never watched a Gundam before, you can watch this Gundam. It doesn't take place in the UC timeline or any previously established timeline. It's its own thing. So you don't need to know any like lore or like historical context. They kind of set that up in the prologue episode, which you'll want to watch first, that talks about, I don't know, how capitalism rules everything around us, basically. Yeah. And then that gets extended out on in the first episode as well, where it's like, yeah, we've got a group of conglomerates that all work together, and they're all kind of vying for the biggest market share, essentially. And it's, yeah. And it's all BS.
Hashtag too real.
Hashtag too real. So,
but I mean, sure, obviously, Gundam can't be political. You know, it's just
about the robots.
Yeah. It's not like it was created by one of the most infamously outspoken and grumpy people to ever set foot in the anime industry.
Has anyone talked to Tomino lately? What does he think about things? You know?
I think the last I heard was him complaining that there is not enough crotch grabbing going on in the Shinkai movies.
Yes.
Where he's like, all these kids, they just keep reaching out their hands to each other, but no one's grabbing any crotches. And what's with that? And it's you know what? You got a point, Tomino.
It's like the way phrasing, you know, phrasing maybe, but yeah, I mean, people have been saying the same thing ever since like Disney kind of got a big profit share margin piece of the entertainment pie. We're like, nobody's fucking in movies anymore. What's going on? Where's all the bumping? I don't. I'm not just a pervert. It's just, you know, it's a thing. Like, people do that. They don't stare longingly.
It's where it's gone.
Yeah.
Everyone's just smelling butts and eating fingers and
talking about smelling butts. Maybe it's about time we talked about Made in Abyss, the biggest butt sniffer show of all time.
I mean, honestly, yeah. I mean,
that's what it is, isn't it?
There's there's a 100, the 100 good deeds of Eddie McDowd. If anyone remembers that deep cut, about the
name is familiar, but never.
It's about the bully that turns into a dog. And I can only imagine. Animorphs, there was some butt sniffing going on in that book series, yeah. I'm sure.
Yeah. 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 Let me just full size this wonderful photo that James Beckett sent to me today before we started this. And you know what? How is this not just the entire show encapsulated? This is Fapita presumably rubbing her scent anal glands on Gabu.
We're all Gabu,
And we're all, yeah, we're all Gabu.
Kushi is Faputa, and we're just like, why are you doing this?
Why are you doing this to us? So I watched episode 11 and then the 45-minute finale back to back. The last time we were here, we didn't get to talk about the finale of Made in Abyss because we had the trailer watch party, and then, you know, there was a week break when there was no show and people had stuff going on and life's just been crazy. So we want to make sure we give this the proper wrap up it deserves. It's gross.
In the best way possible.
The best way possible, yes. James, what can you give us, like, a just, so I mean, last time we left off, it was a confrontation between Faputa and everybody. Reg seemed like, you know, he was siding with the village, and Faputa's entire life goal at this point has been to destroy them and then basically bury her mother by tearing down the giant husk of her body that they all live in. And
normal daughter things.
Just you know, and in the meantime, she's just ripping people apart and eating them. And Nanachi, you know, lets Midi go, and then she gets a new hat.
Oh yeah,
very important.
And a fishing pole.
And a fishing pole. Actually, her entire outfit color theme, I think, changed as well. It seemed like she got.
You had some blue vibes.
Yeah, yeah, some blue vibes, and you know, Belloff is there with her, and. It's just, you know, kind of confrontation to a showdown. The little goo things that are connected to Irumui were helping Faputa as well and healing her. And Belloff, Wazukyan showed us his weird, creepy wooden face.
And his fingers.
And his many, many, many fingers, as Waco just sort of like looked on in horror as all of this was breaking out.
Yep.
I almost wonder if this finale needed to be as long as it was in some ways, because I mean, it all basically takes place in this like open area. And there's just a lot of destruction and then a lot of things getting torn apart and then sometimes things getting eaten. And sometimes they're eaten willingly, and there's some emotional stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the adventure goes on. But it's sort of, I don't know. So I guess my questions for everyone who's listening / watching this right now, and to you, James, is sort of like, what do you take away from the conclusion that Faputa got out of this and like the village itself? Like, there's some weird symbolism sort of things going on.
Yes.
As well. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. So in regards to your question about the length, I think that I don't think it needed to be that long in regards to plot, but I think that was also the case with the season one finale. And in general, I honestly think that plot has never really been Made in Abyss's like focal point. I think the messiest parts of this finale, and I think you could say the same thing about the season one finale, but the season one finale was so much simpler that it was a lot easier to overlook. But I think there are certain things about the plot that are either kind of convenient or like not super spelled out. But I do think that the length really did help the episode as far as the mood and the atmosphere. I think so much of what makes Made in Abyss work really well is those emotional kind of cathartic moments. And I think that you do need a little bit of time just to let those moments sit and to let them have, I think, the proper impact. Like, I think the final probably 15 minutes of this finale to me were basically perfect. And it was almost entirely because of just those emotional beats that hit so well. Even if, like, you know, we were talking a bit off mic about how Wazukyan's whole plan was definitely kind of vague, and it didn't really come to any sort of conclusion, which I think is maybe part of the point. But yeah, I think if you're looking at this purely as like a conclusion to the plot of the kids showing up at this village and the village kind of finally coming to ruin, I think you could probably argue that the last three episodes probably could have been cut down into two. if you kind of split them up a little differently.
Yeah.
But I think mood-wise, you wouldn't, for instance, you wouldn't have had time in episode 10 to play around with the flashbacks to back when Fapato met Reg.
Yeah.
And the episode 11, you wouldn't have had a lot of the time to sit with kind of Fapato's changing perspective when she gets the whiff of Bailoff's memory farts.
Yeah.
Come to call them.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, as far as what I get out of it, I wrote in my review that this season's honestly been kind of a weird one for me because it hit at such a time of, you know, I've been, you know, when my wife and I, we lost our cat, and it's just, it's been a very emotionally tumultuous time for me personally. And so much of what I got out of this finale, I think, really spoke to just a lot of emotions that I've been like just individually going through like over the last few weeks. Uh-huh. And so it's kind of hard for me to separate sort of my subjective reaction to those connections with like what I would have maybe gotten out of it if I'd watched it, you know, 4 weeks ago. But I think what really resonates with me is that kind of running theme of, and they really hit on it at the end, like when Voico has her final moments with Fapato, and Fapato talks about how, you know, she thought she had all of her mother's Irumiwi's memories, but she never knew anything about Voico, and it's because even in her state that she was when she became the village, Irumiwi clung to her love of Voico and those feelings to kind of remain herself, right?
Yeah.
That there could still be a part of her. And the whole idea that, you know, what you are, I think it was, I can't remember who it was, but one of our ANN Annie Twitter mutuals was pontificating about how the whole point of the show this season is like reckoning with how do you deal with the fact that you're just a tube of meat and goo that's eventually going to die horribly somehow or another. Mm-hmm. And I think the conclusion that so much of the season comes to with Fapato is that, you know, more than your past, more than where you came from, more than who your parents were, and more even than like where you physically are in your life, you know, at any point, who you are is in a lot of ways defined by both the pain and the joy and the love and the sadness that you accumulate over the course of your life. And you can either do what the villagers did, and you can find a place of just pure comfort, and you can never move forward, never challenge yourself, never grow, or you can go on an adventure that means that you're going to get hurt, that you're going to meet people who hurt you, that you're going to meet people that you love, that you're going to lose people that you love, that you are eventually, you know, probably going to be lost yourself, and eventually you'll be gone. But if you can, you know, find those new experiences, meet those people who want to go on that adventure with you, leave your mark, you know, right? In the way that even Voico was able to have that gravestone that Fapato made for her at the end, that is, you know, that's kind of the legacy that you leave behind. And that's sort of that's kind of the best thing that you can hope for, right? Is to, even though we're all a bunch of weird meat tubes surrounded by monsters that want to eat us and weirdos with 100 fingers, that we can take all those things, positive and negative, and we can, I don't know, build something out of it that is kind of more meaningful than the sum of its parts, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Oh, it totally does. And I hope I didn't ruin it by showing a dude with too many fingers, but just too hi many there. Fingers.
It's too
hi many. There. I see you're all here, and here's all of my broken fingers. Yeah. What I feel like I got the most out of the finale specifically was, I mean, the parental feelings still those still worked on me. Like that's the one part I got choked up about, was about Irumi's relationship with Weiko and her holding on to those memories, even when like everything fell apart around her and she was turning into this horrible monster. She still remembered and like clung to the feelings that she had for her mom. And we also learned that she shared those feelings with Bailiff too. Like she felt, she saw him as a father figure. We didn't get that quite as much out of the story itself. Maybe, you know, it was because he was always off trying to get resources for them. You know, he was bringing home poisonous food and things like that. But I mean, she also built that connection with him, and it's probably that helped explain Bailiff's own horrible deep remorse he had regarding how they ended up surviving off of Irumi. So it did add to that, and I thought that part worked really well. I had actually a harder time connecting with Weiko compared to connecting with Irumi's ideas of Weiko. Mm-hmm. Maybe just because for a lot of the time, Weiko just seemed really like kind of pathetic. Not, and I don't mean that like in a judgmental, like looking down on her way, but like she just seemed like a really broken character and had a really hard time standing up for herself or making a stand for the things that she thought were important. She really like, you know, understandably gave into, I think, depression towards for most of the latter part of what was going on. And even after she came out of the hole, after Riko took her out of the hole, it just seemed like she was in a state of, she wanted to die, and she had wanted to for a while. And we'd seen that in flashbacks and stuff, but she just, you know, had kind of given up quite a lot. And that's why I kind of thought that the finale for her was almost unnecessary. The
mythification.
Yeah. Occasion of her, you know, Reg breaks the seal and then all the monsters start coming in, and then the village ends up no longer being protected from the curse anymore. And so when she starts going upstairs, raising her depth level, she starts losing her humanity and begins to start looking like Mitty. And this is like, it's really gross body horror stuff that is not acknowledged by anyone around her, which felt really weird. Her eyeball is like hanging down here and it's blackened and dead for like up until she finally dies. But there's a whole episode where she's just sort of like mumbly with her eyeball hanging out, and everyone's like, all right, let's put Weiko in the caravan that we've put together. We're gonna get on out of here. I'm like, can someone please just put her eyeball back in for her? Give her maybe put a little blanket over her or something. Like, lady's falling apart, guys. So I just felt bad for her through the whole thing, and I didn't quite get the same a good sense of like closure from Wazukyan's end of it. The story was never fully committed to like calling him a villain, really. So maybe that was supposed to be kind of the apt way for him to go. But also this arc never seemed to really have a clear villain, which, I mean, life is like that. Mm-hmm. But from a narrative perspective, sometimes it's hard when it's like, okay, so who's going to get the just desserts, or who's going to be the scapegoat for all the horrible shit that's happened, so that when they die,
even that moment,
better, where, you know?
It was so odd. It was one of the odder moments where there's like just a and the show does this sometimes where it'll randomly give Reg like an internal monologue, even though the show doesn't normally do that very much with him. Mm-hmm. But there's a moment where like, as Wazukyan's dying, he kind of talks about how like, you know, he kind of explains like all of this was the result of us trying to care for each other. Isn't that funny? You know, like,
yeah,
all of this was like every individual person doing what they thought was the right thing to do, including me, Wazukyan.
Yeah.
And Reg has that moment where he's like, that's true, but it's like, it's, I think he says, but it's so maddening, you know, like, there's that whole, like, and I think you're right that I think he is intentionally supposed to be very different from,
Bondrian.
because what Bonjour is doing, you know, he's maybe arguing that there's like the pursuit of science or whatever, but you know, it's very clearly like a very selfish and self-centered perspective.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, even as you know, and Jackie was even talking about it back when we were covering everything that was going on with Urumiri, where even though what Wazikian did and what the villagers did was kind of awful and reprehensible, it was also one of those things where you can totally see why they did it, you know, when it was like either that or die. And the way, you know, if they could justify what they were doing as some kind of divine intervention, that their prophet had like found a way for them to, you know, to find sustenance in these creatures that were literally being made for the purpose of being eaten from their perspective. So I think I feel like maybe it almost ties into kind of what happens with Voico, where I was thinking about this as you were talking about how what happens to her is it's just so sad and so pathetic. And I think it kind of ties into the show's perspective on adults in general,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, the nuances and complexities and practicalities of adulthood are always the things that drive characters to either hurt other people or to make mistakes that lead to themselves or other people getting killed. And there's this like recurring theme that like, that one of the reasons that the children are able to make it this far is that they're not burdened with all of that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's almost like the show is sort of saying that Voico, you know, not that she was beyond saving, but that she was too much of an adult to ever be able to recover from what happened, you know.
Yeah.
Like she bore too much responsibility, right? Like she had the burden of protecting Urumiri, the burden of choosing to eat her children, and that for an adult, that's the kind of thing that will just break you,
right?
Like it broke Bailoff, right?
Yeah.
Whereas because the kids don't have that responsibility, because they don't have those complicated and necessarily selfish or externally influenced ideals like Wazikian, or even Bailoff, who like made the decision to keep feeding the water because he had to decide, well, okay, it's either this or I let them die.
Yeah.
Do I, you know, let them die now, or do I try to keep them alive and see if we can fix this? And that those are all like adult concerns, and those are the things that will ruin you, basically. That will make you depressed. Yeah. That will make you, and I don't know. I wonder if it has something to do with the fact that because they're kids, there's that, it's literally like the innocence of childhood.
Yeah.
It's the thing that keeps them alive.
I just wanted to comment real quick. Nordhammer's kind of like hammering down on certain points. Urumiri looks directly at the camera, and we're assuming it's Bailiff's perspective, and says, "Just so you know, Bailiff, I feel the same way about you." And that was immediately following her talking about how Urumiri wasn't like her mom, with the implication that she is her mom. So no, she doesn't straight up say that Bailiff is her dad or sees him as a father figure, but she's like blushing a little. So that's the way I interpreted it, is she was saying, "I feel the same way about you as I do about Waco," as in a parental sense. Otherwise, are we supposed to take that statement as an implication that she feels the same way about Bailiff as he does about her in a romantic sense, which seemed really weird and not probably what they were trying to say. So if it was supposed to be something else, it wasn't clearly defined in the anime, which is what we all watched. So that being said, I also thought one of the symbols that they turned on it, and I don't know how I feel about it necessarily. Fapita seemed to take it okay, but like this part seemed almost like a retribution, or like making up for the fact that they ate, symbolically, that because they ate Fapita's siblings, we get this long extended scene of them feeding parts of themselves to Fapita so that she can heal. And that ends up kind of channeling her transformation towards the end, where she basically willingly accepts them as sacrifices to herself and eats them to become her Super Saiyan Sonic Fapita version with like gold hair and whatnot, and that kind of empowers her to a certain point. I was never really cool with the weird sort of worship aspect that got introduced. I mean, that started with Irumui as sort of an idolization of her because she provided them with food that cured them and then transformed them so they could continue living in this environment. So like, I get why it exists. It's just, and this might be me from a personal perspective as like a non-religious person, that kind of stuff like kind of creeps me out. When people get into this sort of like worshipy state, and there is like, I don't personally perceive Fapita as like, I mean, she came about in really strange circumstances, but so does everything in this show. But I don't really see her as like a deity. But they obviously revere her in that way. Even when she's literally like tearing them apart and eating them and like consuming their life force to continue going on. She has a moment where she basically chooses not to eat a couple of them specifically so they can get Riko out, and then wonders if that was a mistake because she runs out of energy and maybe if she'd eaten them, she would have been okay. And then, you know, we get, oh no, his name's escaping me now. Majikaya possesses her briefly, and that's sort of how she's able to finally be like reinvigorated enough to get out. But that whole scene just kind of felt weird to me.
I can see that totally.
Yeah. Maybe just because like, again, I think symbolically it's supposed to also represent like them paying their pound of flesh for what they took from Irumui. But on the other hand, they're all a bunch of cutesy stuffed animal things using a superheated knife to cauterize the wound as they cut off their own hands. And it's just like,
yeah,
it was a lot. It was a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in there. I liked that development insofar as I liked the overall idea that the ultimate sort of crime that these people committed wasn't even necessarily the baby eating. Like, that was bad, but that was also like, that was kind of a crime out of desperation, right? Like, it wasn't like they didn't
know. They were like, those look good.
Yeah. Like, the only person that might have known what would happen to Irumui was Wazukyan. And the rest of them are like, they were just being eaten the food they were given, right? But the real crime they committed was trying to defy the natural cycle of death and birth that the Abyss is like so emblematic of.
Right.
And there's even that line where I think Mugi's the one who says like, hey, like at the very least, now I'm facing death on my own terms. I'm not just putting it off for however many hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And so I like the idea that like both symbolically and literally they were willingly, because that's like the whole theme, right? It's like, in order to truly conquer the Abyss, even if it doesn't mean reaching the bottom, you have to accept that at some point you're going to die. Like even getting to the bottom, you like, that's the end.
Yeah.
And instead of like ignoring it, and maybe like instead of using like this veneer of religion to justify like ignoring what's happening around you because you feel like you have this like access to eternal life that you've earned because, you know, you happen to eat the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, maybe, you know, it could be some kind of commentary where the show is saying, instead of worrying about how to make your life eternal, maybe instead you should be more focused on how can I, you know, make sure that my life that I live here in the Abyss is being lived to its fullest in a way that I won't have any regrets.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, it's messy. It doesn't really get a whole lot of development. Although I did want to point out before we reached our conclusions, I want to say that I feel vindicated in my standing of Ma because honestly, I didn't know because the previous couple of episodes made me cry so much that I was like, okay, I feel like I've got all my tears out. I'm probably going to get through this finale. Like, you know, I'll be sad, but it's not going to be like when Midi died and I was just a wreck.
But did she give the doll to?
Which she, so when Rico gave Ma the little doll as like an apology for getting torn up by the goop and getting all of her stuff destroyed. And then at the end, when the very last thing that Ma does is hold Rico and make sure she still has her glasses, that's when I was like, I had to hit pause for a bit. I was doing a little bit of the Hugh Jackman and the Fountain Ugly cry. I was just like, Ma was just a good pink grandpa ass little monster.
Oh, it was. Yeah, he got the job of like, you need to support Rico's head because she's passed out. We don't want her to break her neck because, you know, they're like, it's not a smooth ride or whatever. And her glasses fall off. He puts her glasses back on and then gives her the little doll and then fades out. You know, everyone fades out. One of the things about Made in Abyss is there's always that like juxtaposition of those moments and then just sort of the casual cruelty of nature at the same time. Like all the creatures that go in there to just start eating them.
Yeah.
They aren't motivated by like any kind of morality or like choice or whatever. It's just purely opportunistic instinct. And they just,
there's that one turbaned eater that just like steps on the other one because it's, you know,
That was interesting to me because the other one was suffering. It was lame at that point, right? Because it had fallen and busted its legs to the point where it couldn't stand back up. And so the other one, I mean, it seems really indifferent when it does it, but it comes upon it, kind of notices it. And basically, I interpret it as putting it out of its misery. Maybe they were a pair or pair or something, because there was two of them. And so it just walks up to it, notices that, you know, if it didn't kill it there, it probably would have starved to death. So it just like kills it. But on the other hand, I think the example that sort of showed what I'm talking about, like the indifferent cruelty, is to Gabu. Because it just like stomps it to death for no reason.
That made me sad too.
I was really like, upset about that. I was like, why? Yes, okay, yeah, that's what got me, is when they define what haku is. Your butt was my haku.
There were a couple of screenshots where just all the times he just said ooh. I was just like, yeah man, that's a
bad. I wish they could have repaired him. I was kind of hoping they'd be able to repair him or something.
Like at the end of Metropolis, the movie, where there's a, in the Japanese version, there's specifically like the little screenshot at the very end that shows him like putting Tima back together. And as a little kid, I was always like, yes, good. Like, that's
it's okay.
We must put our robot friends back together. That's a part of why they're robots, because you can fix them.
There's something about robots that always gets me like right in the heart when anything bad happens to them. And I think it is that childlike sort of innocence that you can fix it. It doesn't know any better because it lacks the like emotional complexity a lot of the time that humans do. So it's always trying to do its best. And then it gets broken and you're like, no, it's not fair. It was trying its best. You have to fix it.
Like at the end of Iron Giant when like the little screw like rolls away. So it's like, okay, he's coming back. He'll be Superman again. It's okay.
It's gonna be okay. It's all gonna work out. Yeah. So this ends with, you know, see you again next time, Sosu. So and we're supposed to, I think, assume that if she doesn't, this is such a cute picture of her, so I have to put it up on the screen. If she doesn't come back, you know, join up with them immediately, she's gonna maybe find them at some point and officially join the party. But they just sort of head off to the next part of their adventure. And that's kind of it for Made in Abyss right now.
For a while too, presumably, because there's only like three more chapters of the manga that have been written.
Oh, really? I didn't
know it's
that.
At the pace that it's going, it is going to be a good long while before there's enough, I would say even enough for a movie.
I was wondering if they might go the movie route again, depending on, I don't know. I don't know what made them choose that in the first place for the last arc, but I mean,
they basically just started the next arc. Like it's still introducing things. So,
oh, okay.
So, and it's been months.
Yeah.
It'll be a while.
Yeah. Yeah. Overall, I think I enjoyed it. I think I still liked season one more because there was just more variety of environments and whatnot. And, but I did like, you know, a lot of the emotional elements of the story. Fapita is the best. She's my new fave. So, Yeah.
I think for me, it's, I always kind of compare it to how I feel about Avatar, The Last Airbender, and Legend of Korra.
Okay.
Where for me, I think Avatar is a much cleaner and more kind of narratively satisfying story. It has a very like traditional arc, a lot of payoffs, very solid conclusion. Legend of Korra, I would argue, has much lower lows than Avatar ever had, but also the highs that it hits, I think, are really kind of special and unique, even though it's a lot messier. And I think that's how I feel about this season, where I think it's not as clean. It doesn't have, I think, as simple and raw of an emotional catharsis as that, like, final balloon scene, which is, like, to me, I think, one of the top 10, like, anime scenes I've ever seen in my life. But I think some of the really cool, weird, creative stuff that this season did, I thought was just like nothing I'd ever seen. And so,
yeah, definitely could not compare it to any other story or any other narrative that I've encountered. There's really nothing else like it. I mean, I read Dante's Inferno. This is still not that. So yeah, it's
nowhere near as much butt smelling and fart eating and
no
belly button puncturing and.
There's definitely some farting, actually, now that you mention it. There's some farting demons in Dante's Inferno on one of the levels.
Do the farts possess the body of a four-armed, anal gland-wiping princess?
No. Just generic farting. No supernatural possession farting. But
get it together, Allegary.
Come on. All right, everybody. Thanks for sticking us out for the Made in Abyss season edition of this. We will be back again next week talking about more premieres and more anime news. Jackie will be back from, you know, doing New York Comic Con for us, so we can maybe talk a bit about that. Again, we will be covering Chainsaw Man here, but also there's no way that we can avoid talking about like Mob Psycho and Pop Team Epic and the new Gundam and all the other great stuff that's going to be airing this season, My Hero Academia. So make sure to join us each week on Mondays, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Me, James, Jackie, it'll be a good time. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye-bye.